Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Phoenix, Arizona. It's time for Valley Business Radio, spotlighting the Valley's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Hello and welcome to Valley Business Radio, where we tell the stories that traditional media tends to ignore and help connect you to the right people. I'm your host, Dr. Adrian McIntyre, and I'm joined in the studio today by Michelle Trent, owner and founder of Remembered Well, and PK Fields, founder and CEO of Eldersense.com. Welcome to both of you.
Hey, thank you. It's a pleasure being here today with you.
Awesome to see you.
Michelle, let's start with you and tell us a little bit about Remembered Well. What does your company do and how do you serve folks?
Well, you know how there's a saying that everybody has a story to tell? That's absolutely true. And so what I do, what Remembered Well does and what the company stands for is collecting those stories, those wonderful stories and memories that all of our loved ones have, recording them in a digital format, organizing them, making sure that they're clean and crisp and sharp and easy to listen to and an enjoyable narrative so that the family always has that, has the sound of their loved one's voice and has those precious memories and stories as part of their family legacy.
This is such an important aspect of lives, especially because most people don't realize that they can do this until it's too late. How did you get started and what made you realize that a kind of personal history and legacy storytelling practice was a good idea?
Yeah, when you mentioned that people don't usually do this until it's too late, that's probably the number one thing that I hear when I tell people what I do, is they say something along the lines of, oh, I wish I would have. I wish I would have known about your service before, you know, fill in the blank. My mom, my dad, my aunt, my uncle passed away because they had the best stories. And of course, that makes me sad because when those stories are gone, when the person's gone, they take all that history and lore with them. But to answer your question about how I got started, I was faced with a similar dilemma. My dad, who had struggled with cancer for years, and he struggled with it, but he was such a strong man, such a lucky fellow. I was just sure that he was the one that was going to outlive the diagnosis that he was given. And I believed that right up until I was in the Mayo hospital and the doctors called us in and they said, you know, your dad only has 2 more weeks. There's nothing more we can do. And at that point, as a daughter, I'm thinking, I am going to lose this man and he's not going to be around. And I want to save every piece of him that I possibly can. And it was my husband who actually suggested, he said, why don't we record your dad? And I wasn't sure at the time. I thought, oh, I don't know if we'd want to do that, if this is the right time, you know, that all this is happening. But I thought, you know, I was desperate. So I asked him, I said, Dad, would you be willing to do this? And I could just see that he just lit up at the thought that I wanted to hear his stories and that he could actually do something proactive at that time and that he would live on. And so that's what I did. I mean, we went to the Mayo Hospital and we finished up in hospice, but I took the recorder and the mics. We actually had access to that because of our jobs. And I asked my dad every question I could think of. And I said, you know, tell me every story that you remembered. And I learned more about my dad probably in the last 2 weeks of his life than all the knowledge that I had of my dad prior to, which is a little bit embarrassing. But at the same time, I'm so grateful that I had that experience and captured those stories so I can listen to them again and again.
As somebody who works as a professional storytelling consultant, and you and I have discussed the nature of this craft before, one of the things that I try to get people to understand is that mostly we're not walking around with a bunch of stories. What we have is lived experience. And a lot of that is pre-linguistic. The process itself turns the experience into the narrative, turns the experience into the story. And there's a discovery that happens even for the teller of the tale as she or he remembers more and it opens up more. Does this happen when you are doing your personal history work with people, that it sparks their own memory and there's something exciting about remembering? Not all memories are good, but the process itself is fascinating. Talk a little about that.
Oh, without a doubt. You're absolutely spot on. And that once you start asking those questions, it seems like a door opens and then another door opens and another door opens and the memories just flood in. And you hear comments like, oh, I haven't thought about that in years. Oh, that was such a sweet time in my life. There's something really fantastic about being able to look back and make sense of the events, the experiences that you had in your life. And when you're at a viewpoint that you are looking back, you can make sense of the things, the different threads, the different circumstances. Whereas when you're in it, we can be so anxious about where we're at or where we're not at, or if something bad happened, like you said, bad things happen as well. But when you're looking back on it, you can make sense of it. And sometimes storytellers will tell me that, oh, I don't want to talk about that because it's, you know, kind of negative, you know, it's not the most positive thing. And what I'll remind them is that's whatever they learned from it, the lesson that they got, that is the wisdom that they're imparting to somebody else. Because certainly we connect with people, not only from the good experiences that we have, but we connect with people through the tragedy and the hardship that we've overcome as well. So I definitely don't want them to stay away from that, because that really paints their whole picture, their whole story, their experience of life.
I've said many times, as I explain the process I go through, which is in a very different context, mm-hmm. I'm working with professionals, business leaders, mm-hmm. executives who want to communicate more effectively, and I want them to be more human in the process and share personal anecdotes in a meaningful way. One of the things that people often bump up against is there's so much they don't remember because there's a few things they can't forget.
Mm.
And we get stuck with some of those stories as if it's the whole story. It's just human nature. So the process that you take people through also includes some sort of, I don't know, healing, but in any case, reframing, kind of connecting in a different way with events in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
What's that like for you as you sit and lead them through this process and ask the questions that prompt the stories? What's mm-hmm. your experience?
Well, my experience is just as a very interested observer. I find everyone I talk to, they're just so interesting. What they've done is so interesting. And what they need is somebody who will listen to them, ask the questions, and be interested, which I absolutely am. I'm hearing all of this for the first time. So I just find it remarkable in all their experiences. But just as you noted, and you're so much more educated in this. But one of the things I found out through working with my dad is the hospice nurse would come and say, oh, your dad is so uplifted after you come and he gets to talk about his experiences and his stories. And so I started doing a little bit more research about that. And there absolutely is a therapy called, I think it's called reminisce therapy, which is just people getting to reconcile their life. They get this walk down memory lane and they get to see, like, it made sense and I did something and I was value and I was here and I was somebody. That just buoys the spirit. It's beautiful to see.
We often talk about reflecting as if it's a positive thing. And of course, for a lot of people, the past is not a pleasant place mm-hmm. because, again, we're stuck with some of those more traumatic, more upsetting things, and we make interpretations about ourselves as a result of what happened. So what we're really stuck with is the negative view we have of us, and the stories we're telling ourselves about ourselves are not nice ones.
Mm-hmm.
But in order to reframe it, as I say, before you can connect the dots, you've got to collect the dots. And so you're inviting people to take that walk down memory lane and remember things and moments. What is this like for the families when you put together the finished product? First of all, what is the product? What do they get?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a chaptered audio book, essentially. So it is a long narrative. So it is all in audio format. So I make sure to take the time to pull out that descriptive detail so that you can envision in your head what it was like for your loved one to live where they lived, grow up where they grew up. You know, they don't, the folks that I'm interviewing are usually in like their 70s or 80s or 90s even. They don't have the documented life that we do today with Facebook and taking pictures, everything. So I want to be really descriptive to kind of take you through where they were. And your mind, as you listen to it, is unlimited. So you can absolutely see yourself there. And because it's a longer narrative, these might be an hour and a half. And I recognize that people don't have an hour and a half to listen to someone's story. So I break it down into these chapters that are very much bite-sized. So it might be 5 minutes that you're going to, you know, hear about their youth and going to grade school. It might be 10 minutes about their career. It might be 3 minutes about how they met their spouse. So they're just little bite-sized pieces. And then it's delivered ultimately on a USB drive. So you can put it into, you know, whatever computer system that you have. And then you can download it all kinds of different ways. You can listen to it on your phone, in the car. I just wanted to make it very portable and easy to listen to. And the response that I get back then from families usually is, wow, I didn't know that. I didn't realize that about my mom. Mom, you never told me that. And then the mom usually will say, well, yes, I did. I told you that 1,000 times. And, you know, they just
or
had this.
You never asked. So well, you get both.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. It could be that too. But they think that they have shared this piece of wisdom. And then, but for whatever reason, you know, we just weren't connecting. And so even if you've told those stories before, I would say tell them again, because my dad and some of the stories that I collected from him, maybe he did tell me, I think he didn't, but maybe he did tell me, and I just wasn't ready to receive the information at the time. But you can bet when it becomes a point that he's not going to be around, I want that information. And now it is vitally important to me, as it is for all families.
I spent some time as an undergraduate and also in graduate school studying social history and cultural history. And the core idea of those disciplines is that the small voices that don't make it into official history are interesting and compelling. Of course, the sources for constructing this kind of history are hard to come by. So you need to find personal archives of some form or another. I had a professor when I was studying the history of the Middle East who had written an entire book on Aleppo in the 18th century, sort of under the Ottoman era, and he meticulously reconstructed life in the city of Aleppo from Islamic court records, which were cases about, you know, somebody, you know, stole some money from me, or divorce cases, or, and the little narratives in here were really all there was that would let you see the lives of the people. But based on 100,000 of these records, he reconstructed the history of Aleppo. Now in the 21st century, that Aleppo is gone. War has destroyed it. In fact, Abraham Marcus's book on Aleppo in the 18th century is now a book about an Aleppo that 15 years ago you could have visited, but now is gone, and it has an entirely new place in the memory and the history of the Eastern Mediterranean, of the Middle East. I'm fascinated by the fact that our personal lives have something, a quality like this as well. For the most part, we don't document. I mean, Instagram now is coming in as a kind of personal archive, and it's fascinating to see. You know, my kids are growing up fully documented. On last count, my wife has over 3,000 posts on her Instagram account. So our children's childhood is there in pictures and in words and her experience and things. So that's cool. That's unique. Most people are not documenting their lives, and their grandchildren and great-grandchildren and great-great-great-grandchildren will never know anything about them, which, by the way, is how it's always been. But for the first time, you can do something about it. Do you have a sense of participating in this kind of something of significance for human history, or are you just focusing more on the individual? I'm getting carried away with that.
Well, but I really like how you're presenting it, actually. I'm completely bought in. And yes, in a way, I think how you framed it makes me see the importance of it even more. But one of the things that I hear from people is they say, well, you know, I just don't have a very interesting story. Like my grandmother, she did, or my great grand, but you know, or they lived through the war, the depression or whatever, and my story is not all that interesting. And that's just not true, because all of us have an interesting story. Just the way that we've lived being so different then than it is now. I mean, just the passing of time, it's been remarkable with the with technology and what we've gone through in the last even 20 years. I mean, that those are remarkable stories, plain everyday stories. When I have somebody that will tell me that they had an outhouse, for instance, I mean, they're walking around. These people are still here and they experience life with an outhouse. Well, that is going to, that's mind-blowing to their kids or their great, their grandkids, but their great, great grandkids have no idea what it was like even without a cell phone. That was hardship, you know? So hearing these stories about how they had to haul water in or use an outhouse, or, I mean, these everyday details, because they're so different, they're fascinating. And as you said, that's what like paint, this is your family. This is part of your legacy, part of your lineage, and getting to understand how these people were and how they lived. It's just, it's all remarkable, even the small details. So if anyone is listening and thinking, oh, I just don't have a story, that's not true. They have a story, just as you mentioned with Aleppo. That is our collective story.
Everybody has a story, many, many stories. PK Fields, you're the founder and CEO of ElderSense, and I want to bring you into this conversation, both because I see you had something you wanted to say to Michelle, but also because I want you to talk a little bit about your company. And Michelle, we're going to circle back. I know you brought some samples, some excerpts mm-hmm. of the storytelling, so we'll do that a little bit okay. later in the show. Mm-hmm. PK, tell us a little bit about ElderSense.
ElderSense is similar to Hotels.com or an MLS system to find assisted living, memory care, or residential care homes. And my background was I had built the original websites for Bellagio Treasure Island, Mirage Gold Nugget, and then went on to Caesars Group, where I had 5 brands and 17 hotels. And then I was at Starwood Corporate, and I wound up in a case manager's office at a hospital for my dad. And they kept giving me brochures, and I said, there's something wrong with this. If you can book a hotel online, why can't you look at every assisted living online, get information, read a review, and connect with them directly, set up a tour, and see what works for your family and move in? And that's how I came up with it.
When did you start the company? When did you have your first minimum viable product, as they say, in the startup world?
I moved here in April of 2015 to launch it from Los Angeles. And I chose Phoenix because in Arizona, there are 2,200 licensed facilities for assisted living, either large communities or residential care homes, and 80% of those are within a 50-mile radius of Phoenix. So if I'd gone to Florida, I would have had the East Coast and the West Coast to market to. I was in California. It was too big to test it out. And after being here now, we're going into year 4 because we actually launched in August of 2015. We're working with several hospital groups, which is rather exciting. We've got a big program we're rolling out with the discharge planners of Banner. And all I do is tour communities, and we're now in a few states, and it's been really interesting. And in between this, we get people who will call our 800 number, and sometimes it's a senior saying, how do I do this? How do I move in? How do I find a place? How do I pay for it? There's so many questions, and we're there to help people through this stage of their life.
I was going to ask you, what are people doing now? Is it still kind of hit and miss? You get some brochures, you do a Google search. Without ElderSense, what do people have to go through to find this kind of...
Well, and you know, people used to go to the Yellow Pages. Now we just go to Google, and everything is on Google. So you have different sites, but a lot of times on a different website, you'll have to put in your information. A lot of people don't want to fill out a lead generation form with your name, your phone number, your email address, because they then don't want to be bombarded with phone calls. So we don't have that. And although we are on Google, we allow people to come on our site and find anything they're looking for. What's worked great for us, as I mentioned, with hospitals or rehabilitation centers or skilled nursing centers is when all of a sudden someone was well enough to be discharged, but they can no longer live on their own because they can't cook for themselves or they can't necessarily dress themselves and they need help every day doing something, that assisted living is the choice, but someone leaving a community, having the opportunity to look and see everything that's out there than just a select few, that's what we provide them with.
Media coverage of assisted living and senior care often focuses on the scandals, the horrific moments when something's gone wrong, when there's abuse or poor conditions or things of that nature. And so a lot of people must have some sort of just basic fear and concern. They want to do right in most cases. They want to do right by the elders in their family. And yet the lack of information, the lack of transparency must create a problem. How do you address some of those basic human fears and concerns on the platform?
The biggest human fear, similar to what you're saying, besides seeing the stories on the 11 o'clock news, because they only write up what's, you know, horrific per se, not, oh, look how wonderful these people are having such a great time here, are the misconception are seniors, people really who are 70 plus, who remember visiting a relative and it wasn't assisted living, it was a nursing home. And they remember walking into a sterile hospital with white walls that had an odor that was very hospital-like, whereas assisted living today is similar to being in a sorority house or a frat house. I went into
toga parties. Is that I'm getting a very vivid image here.
You can't even imagine the fun that is set up in different communities, the activities going on. And there's a community I want to turn you on to that's local here. And it's right in this area, but they have happy hour every day, 3 to 5 o'clock. And I was touring with someone the other day because I hadn't been there recently. And as you walk up to the upstairs area, you are hearing laughter and noise. And the marketing liaison looked and said, I should only give tours during this time. I said, that would be true. Because you walk in and everyone is just having the best time.
Yeah. A number of years ago in San Francisco, I delivered a lecture series at the Rhoda Goldman Center, which is a fairly upscale independent living and assisted living facility in San Francisco. And I was doing a series of lectures on the history of the Middle East. That's a former life expert area of mine. And the average age in the room for these things was probably 85, because there was as many people over 100 as there were under 80. You know, an average is right. The way that works out, right? There was a guy in the room who was 104 years old who remembered the Ottoman Empire, and kind of blew my mind about that. But it was a wonderful place. And you're right, those memories that we have of the nursing homes and that smell, I'm so glad you mentioned it. What is that? I actually don't want to know, but there's that.
It's medicinal almost.
Yes, yes.
And it just brings back when you were taken there as a child or you were visiting someone, as I mentioned. And it goes back to what Michelle's doing. Memories are so important, but that's not a memory you want to hold on to, yet a smell can bring it back.
Right. Like Proust wrote about that in Remembrance of Things Past, the smell of the Madeleine took him back to his childhood. That's not the smell memory you want.
No.
The hospital. I'd rather have the cookie.
The cookie, the cake smell. And as you were saying before regarding Instagram, like we're on Instagram for all different communities we visit. All different assisted living places are also on Instagram showing what fun and what activities are taking place there.
I'm not as educated about this as I'd like to be, but I know there's a demographic challenge here with the aging population of a substantial size needing options. And at the same time, building a platform like you're building, the complexity, the tech side, but really the complexity of the relationships and the partnerships you have to create, this must be even more challenging than some of the entertainment industry and hotel hospitality things you have worked on in the past. What are some of the unique challenges you're facing in building and rolling out Eldersense.com?
It is our largest competitors are national, and they have a different business model. And you go onto their website, and you fill out a form, and you start getting phone calls. But you think you're talking to a community, and next you find out you're talking to a call center. And for us, it's getting the information out to enough people to know that when you go on our website and you call a community or a residential care home, you're calling that home. You're speaking to the marketing person or the owner or manager of a home or community to find out what is actually happening there.
So it's a little bit like if you're trying to rent a car and you call the number, but you're not talking to the airport Hertz counter.
Correct.
In Phoenix. You're talking to the National Sales Center, wherever that is.
Right.
And what you really want to talk to are the people at the location where you're going. I didn't realize there was so much of that in the traditional model. That's a unique and compelling feature. What else are you dealing with as you build this out? How do you form the partnerships that are necessary to make this work? What is the business model?
Our current business model is a subscription base. So we'll list everyone in the state. And that's the freemium model, where we'll list one picture, an address, a phone number, and some pricing. And for you to find out information, more information, those homes or communities pay us a monthly fee. It's $100 a month if it's a 10-bed home. If it's 5 beds, it's $50 a month. Large communities pay us $200 a month. And that way you can go on and see 15 pictures, 70 data points, a write-up blog post just on that community. In the future, we'll be linking more videos. But I learned from Steve Wynn a long time ago, and I said, shouldn't we have videos? And he said, no, we shouldn't, because if you walk into a restaurant today and I change it tomorrow and paint a wall, they're going to come in expecting to see one thing, and you're not going to redo the video every time. So pictures are so much easier, and people snap through them. And when you're looking for a hotel, you don't usually go on and look at all different, you know, videos. You just want to get an idea and feel for the place.
You compared ElderSense a few minutes ago to hotels.com, but which makes perfect sense, but also to an MLS system. The MLS example is interesting because there are a lot more different types of professionals involved in real estate transactions than there are in booking a hotel room. So creating and sustaining those relationships to make the platform work for everybody, buyers, sellers, and all of this, the additional support, the title companies, the lenders, everybody that has to be involved in that transaction. What are some of the players around the proverbial table, although they're not really sitting down together? Who's involved in something like finding an assisted living facility for my aging parents? Mom, if you're listening, I'm not trying to put you away just yet. I'm curious who's involved.
And Adrian's mom, if you're there and you have any questions, just call our number, 8557-LOVED-ONE, and I'm more than happy to answer any question for you. He's Perfect. Not trying to put you away. Either the senior themselves, one of their children, or someone in a hospital setting professional. But the other people at the table, which is interesting, are in Arizona alone, as I mentioned, you have 2,200 licensed communities or assisted living residential care homes. 250 of those 2,200 have more than 10 beds. The rest are residential care homes that could be down the street from you and you're not even aware, because once a senior is brought in to live in a residential care home, most of the time, they're not taken out often because they have a sedentary life. They get up, they'll walk in the backyard where it's gated. There's a walking path. They eat at the same table, but mobile doctors will come in. Mobile x-rays will come in. So they don't have to be carted around if they need anything. All the needs are met and brought to them. So those homes, some are one-offs, meaning a family or a person could own one home. Or you've got people who have 5 homes, and sometimes they don't even have a website. So just having a page on ElderSense allows them to market themselves and send out a link so they can see, other people can see all their pictures and information.
In the past, PK, you have, when you were living in Los Angeles, you served on the board of the UCLA Center on Aging. And you currently sit on the board of the CMSA Phoenix.
Actually, I just left the Case Managers Association after being on it for 2 years. And I left the Arizona Assisted Living Association here because as we're branching out in new states, I'm getting involved in other boards in other states.
Marvelous. And the question still holds, which is this gives you an interesting view on a variety of expert perspectives on the aging industry, for lack of a better phrase. What are some of the bigger issues beyond what you're dealing with that are being discussed and debated? And what is the general collective of professionals who are dealing with aging populations? What's on their mind? What's happening now?
Well, aging in place is a very big trend where people want to stay where they are. They've been in a home for 40 years. They want to stay in that home. And unfortunately, if you're a couple and something happens to one of you where you someone has a stroke and they're not completely recuperated and the other person tries to manage taking care of them, that creates a decline. And although they want to stay in the home and you try to keep adapting that home, it becomes a difficult situation where as one declines and unfortunately could potentially pass away, then the other person who's been in that large home is isolated. So how do you deal with isolation? And isolation is one of the biggest challenges that anyone's dealing with right now for people of a certain age. When you can no longer drive, but you're in a home, how do you get out and how do people visit you? And what if you're not visited for a week? And who's cooking your meals? And if you're getting Meals on Wheels, another challenge is those who are signing up for Meals on Wheels. In this state, there's still a waiting list. You can't get on. So there's a lot of issues with low-income housing, people who did not save up to take care of themselves because they didn't anticipate living this long. And we're just not set up for it, not just in Arizona, but around the country. And that's some of the challenges we're currently facing.
This is something I can certainly relate to indirectly because my mother worked in public health for the first 15 years of her professional career after the Navy nurse and raising a couple kids. She went back to work in public health in Riverside County and was working in remoter, underserved, low-income areas of rural Riverside County. And as a kid, you know, me and my sister and the neighbor kids, whoever she was responsible for that afternoon, we often had to just pile in the car and ride around on home visits, you know, all the way up to Hesperia, all the way down to Hemet, all over Riverside County. And I remember this was my first exposure. You know, I had a relatively privileged childhood in a comfortable middle class suburb in Riverside. To go out into these outlying areas, and the home care nurse was the point of contact with the world. A lot of times we would just sit in the car, but sometimes we would come in to the house, depending on, you know, who the person was and whether they were comfortable with that or not. These were repeat visits week after week, so there was relationships that were formed. But it was that that primary care provider, that case manager, that level of attentiveness is where a lot of the problems would be identified. Not just changing bandages and catheters and things like that, which no kid should ever have to know about, but also really having a sense of, have you eaten today? You know, what's in your fridge? Well, this is spoiled. Let me throw that out for you. And I watched my mother just kind of get in there and help and take care of people. To know that this sort of thing is still happening even in an urban area where smaller homes or people aging in place might be around the corner and we don't know it. There's a lack of visibility around some of the challenges the vulnerable aging population faces. What do we do about that?
I think telemedicine has become a big new area in terms of being able to track people with different products in terms of blood pressure, heart rate, without having to go to a doctor. But it hasn't changed. The home visits haven't changed because it's a high-touch situation. You know, the whole thing is human touch. As people age, at any age, you need human touch. And people who are out in situations, which is rural, and not getting that is a difficult situation. People in the city, you can walk out your door and you'll see people on the street that you can interact with.
Yeah, for sure. Michelle, coming back to you, you're not working with as many of those low-income populations because the storytelling and the legacy is less of a medical necessity. Although, I don't know, given the psychological benefit, maybe it should be considered a pro-social activity of some sort or another. As you're engaging with people, inviting them to tell their stories, you're also witnessing their current state of mind and living conditions and so on, maybe in less vulnerable places than I'm remembering from the 80s in rural Riverside County. But at the same time, this gives you a unique insight into the aging process. What are you learning? What are you taking away from your work in that regard?
There's much that I'm learning, certainly, because I'm the beneficiary of all this wisdom that's being passed along to me. One thing is a gentleman who I interviewed, and he was in his 90s. And so he's not certainly as mobile as he once was. He's still living in an independent living facility, and it's a beautiful apartment. So I can absolutely echo what PK said about this is you know, I kind of liken it to college because they have all these activities and, you know, they get to go to food services and have a great meal and they get outings. I mean, it's just, it's phenomenal. But one of the things he said to me, which I found so remarkable, because again, I'm looking at this man, he's clearly advanced in age. And he said this, when I asked him, what is the best time in your life? He said, well, right now is pretty good. And, you know, somebody is looking at aging going, oh, that's not something I don't want to get older. I don't want to lose my facilities and things like that. And he's saying, you know, it's pretty good. I still have my wife of, oh my gosh, almost 70 years. I'm still living on my own. I get to see my kids and my grand. The way he was describing it and the appreciation for his life, I thought, well, that's really remarkable. You know, sometimes it's tempting to look at aging as, oh, that's just a terrible thing. But being there and looking back, they can say, no, my life is good.
Now, we're in an audio-only medium at this point. This is radio. And a lot of times people are working with products or services that are hard to convey with words. But you're working in an audio medium with words, and you've brought a few excerpts from some of your storytelling sessions. Let's take a listen and set this up for us. What are we going to hear and what are we going to learn from listening over the shoulder of some of your work?
I have. Let's definitely listen to one. Let's listen to one about war times. And one of the things that I like about this is it's the gentleman is explaining it to me. He was a kid during World War II, so he had this sort of unique perspective. And I love interviewing someone and really digging into their youth because I know this is something that their kids have no vision to. Like their kids have shared memories with them as a parent, but they have no idea of them as a child. So let's listen to that and I'll describe a little bit more.
The very first memory goes back to when I was about four, maybe five, you know, that's a long time ago. We lived in West Seattle, which was fairly close to the beach. I mean, it was within 8-10 blocks. It was wartime, getting ready for war, 1942, and I was about 4 years old. And I remember this fellow coming to the door. He had a white helmet with some kind of insignia on it, and he was the block warden. And his job was to make sure that everyone was pulling down their curtains at night so no light escaped the windows, because the fear was there were Japanese boats out in Puget Sound somewhere, submarines coming up to observe what was going on in the Seattle-Tacoma area. So the warden's job was to make sure no one let any light out. Also, he delivered buckets of sand. I can remember those buckets of sand, which you were to keep at your front door for putting out spot fires in case the Japanese sent some kind of weaponry, you know, into your house and a fire got started, then the sand would help you put the fire out. So that was my, you know, as a four-year-old, five-year-old, that was, you know, pretty impressive, this whole scene, which is so foreign. Well, it would be foreign today to anybody. And so very, very impressive. Well, a little scared, because why do we need to worry about a fire? You know, why can't we let light out the windows? What do you mean there might be enemy out there? It was hard to comprehend. So scary, yes, I would say so.
What I found so fascinating about that is I never, as I studied World War II, you know, in high school and college and that, I always thought it was some, other than Pearl Harbor, it was something that took place, you know, outside of the U.S. soil. And what Sam made me realize is that when he was living in the Puget Sound area, again, and all the water that was nearby, that was a worry that they lived with on a day-to-day basis. And it just never occurred to me that that could have been an experience. And he went on to say how they had some beachfront property, and the military said, can we use your property to do these military exercises? And so they were training like at his house. And the four-year-old boy, of course, soldiers, you know, he was really fascinated by it. I'm sure his parents had a much different opinion of what that situation was like. But again, it just gives you a little bit more of a well-rounded sense of history, because you're getting to hear it and from the first a firsthand perspective of somebody who lived it and lived it differently than what you're probably reading about or what's portrayed in the movies. It was just this innocent kid taking on the patrols, coming in with sand because our house, we might need to put out a fire because the Japanese who are our enemies are patrolling nearby.
You've got a recording here of your own father.
I do, yeah.
Can we listen to that one?
Oh, I'd love to, sure.
We went to a school dance. And at that time, I was a senior. You know, you've got the big men on campus, and then you got the others. And I was one of those cock-of-the-walk type guys. That, anyway, I was at the dance and looked over, and here's this very pretty young lady who had exquisite legs. I'm very beautiful. She was just very beautiful. And I tried to dance with her a couple times, and she wasn't real receptive to it. She had a friend that was with her. And this is where Sherry's idea and mine vary a little bit, but I started making up to her friend to try to find out more about Sherry. And by golly, just one thing led to another, and drove home with, as I recall, I think I drove home with Sherry's friend to their house. And boy, her dad was not happy with me. I was one unwelcome son of a gun. Yeah, I was a masher. Just didn't want anything to do with me. But he was a builder. My dad was a builder. And they hated each other. And then somehow or another, her dad said she couldn't go out with me. Well, you don't tell Sherry no. She got permission to go out as long as it was a double date. And that was interesting. Double date. At that time, I was not only working at the store, but I'd also doing a little bit of logging, firewood and that kind of stuff. And that day, I took an axe and split my toe open. And so I could barely walk. Went and picked Sherry up, and she realized what had happened. And the fact that I actually didn't back out and not just took her, she liked that. Somebody was tough enough to do that.
What's it like hearing his voice again? And I know you probably listen often, but...
I do listen often. Because we just had Father's Day, right? So that's one of those times. It's not that I listen every day, but his birthday, Christmas, Father's Day, and then the opening day of football season, because that was something that he and I shared, was this love of football. But hearing that, it's so clear. I mean, it just sounds like my dad. So it just takes me back to a time when I was with my dad. It's like he's here. He just feels very close when he's doing that.
There's got to be a sense as well in which the storytellers, in this case, the people you are interviewing using a personal history, oral history methodology, must also feel validated and special because somebody is taking the time and the care to listen and elicit these stories. That's got to be rewarding for both sides.
Absolutely, it is. And when their kids will say, "Mom, Dad, I want your stories. I want you to share them. We've purchased this package and we want you to record them." They just light up. They just light up. I mean, sometimes at the beginning, they'll be like, "Oh, no, you know, I don't have anything important to say." And then you start asking them questions and then they just start talking and building this beautiful story that ultimately will build connections for generations and generations.
What do families say? What's their reaction? It's got to be unexpected. We touched on this a little bit earlier, but is there a moment or an example you can think of where it was something unexpected happened and the outcome was not what either you or the family predicted?
When something unexpected happened...
I mean, obviously there's an appreciation
right
for the gift you're giving. And you're playing an editorial role in the process. So you're probably not surprised by the finished product. You've made it in a way. You've put this together. You've edited the clips and selected them. Have you gotten any feedback beyond just, "Oh, this is amazing, thank you so much"? Has there been anything that spoke to the impact?
Yes, there was. There was one situation where I interviewed a couple. And so not only did her daughter have the experience of, "Oh, I didn't know about this or that with my mom and my dad," but then she shared it with her daughter. So it would be the granddaughter of the people that were the actual storytellers. And the granddaughter was so overwhelmed by it. And she was so passionate about it. And that was something that wasn't expected really by any of us, because honestly, kids today, here I go, you're thinking they will appreciate this, and you know that they will, but you think maybe they'll need to appreciate it after they have their own kids or, you know, at some other point in their life. But this young woman was, you know, fresh out of high school. And when she heard the stories of her grandparents, she was probably the most excited in the family that they have this. She just couldn't believe it. She's like, "Mom, I'm so glad you did this. We'll have them forever. And I didn't know this and I didn't know that." And so hearing the enthusiasm of somebody who I guess we didn't expect to be as enthusiastic about it was especially rewarding.
PK Fields, with Eldersense.com, what kinds of reactions do you get either from families or from the various providers that you interact with, the various experts, the various facilities? What are people saying about your platform? What's their response?
I get a lot of, I wish I had known about this when I was trying to find a place for my parents. And other people who've moved into communities who then come back and say, thank you, my parent is so happy now. And it's wonderful to hear that, or stop by and see seniors that we've worked with who are saying, this has changed my life. I now have new friends. I'm interacting. I'm having activities. I don't watch the Diamondbacks by myself anymore. So it feels good.
How are you growing and expanding the platform? You've talked about other states. Arizona was essentially the launch pad and will continue to be a major geographical area. Obviously, our median age here has just gone up by 2 years, and it takes a lot mathematically to move a median. So there's a significant population here. But how are you expanding the platform?
We're now in Nevada, and we're going into Colorado.
What's that like? Is it difficult to begin the process of raising awareness for this, or is it something that catches on really quickly because there's such a desperate need for it?
The homes don't have a lot of options of how to market themselves. So when they see us as an option, they love signing up, which is great. But the hospitals, for them, it's a great resource. And they're like, oh my gosh, I didn't know we could do this. And we just have a postcard that literally hospitals will pass out to people and families.
Michelle, how are you growing your business with Remembered Well? How does the word get out? You get mostly referrals. You do a lot of marketing. What are you doing to help spread the word about this essential service?
For the most part, it's just explaining it to people. When they hear it, they think, oh, this is a great concept. And so then the next step is just trying to get them to actually go about and doing it, because oftentimes people will think, well, that's a great concept, but I'll do it someday. And you know the tricky nature of someday that can easily become none day, and it just doesn't happen. So familiarity through networking groups, that they can always visit my website, which is rememberedwell.com, Facebook, of course, and then referrals from people that I've already interviewed. As PK was saying, I've been to several of the communities around here. They're fantastic, and these seniors are linking arms with other seniors that they're close to. So being able to be referred by clients that I've already recorded is an important source.
Your entire work is premised on the notion that future generations deserve to know about those who came before them. And every human being deserves to be remembered well. It's a valuable service you're providing. Where can people learn more? You mentioned the website. If they want to follow you and follow your journey on social media or what have you, how do they learn more and begin to explore whether or not this would be a good fit for them?
The website is a great resource. You can also find Remembered Well on Facebook and Instagram. We brought Instagram up earlier. It's Remembered Well Stories on Instagram. And then if they want to just talk to me personally, because of course I would do a free story consult with anybody and just explain a little bit about the service and what we might want to capture as part of their story, they can reach me at Michelle. It's with one L, M-I-C-H-E-L-E, at rememberedwell.com, or they can always give me a call too at 623-696-6998.
Michelle Trent, owner and founder of Remembered Well, thank you so much for joining us for this conversation today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
PK Fields, where do people learn more about Eldersense? Where do they connect with you personally if they have resources or opportunities they want to bring to your attention? How do they get into your world?
Eldersense.com. Contact us, or pk@eldersense.com.
Founding any venture of this nature is no small undertaking, and I acknowledge you for everything you're doing to serve our aging populations. You really are the embodiment of respect for your elders, and I appreciate that about you. Thank you for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for this opportunity. It's always good to see you, Adrian.
For all of us here at Business Radio X, this is Dr. Adrian McIntyre, and we'll see you next time on Valley Business Radio.